That was great. Thank you for leading that. That's a great song. I mean, it really is. It is a great song. The catchphrase, you talk about catchphrases in culture. People talk about, yes.
The Imitation Song, we don't have PowerPoint.
Yes.
Is 909.
909, Invitation Song, if you want to mark it. We're going old school with the books. We got to say that before so we don't surprise you. 909 is the Invitation Song. All right. Mark chapter 9 is where we're going to be this morning. And the title of the lesson is, Who is Great? Who is Great? Before we jump into the lesson, though, while you're turning to Mark chapter 9, I wanted to give you a message from the Parsons family. This would be Ryan, the minister at National Road. I spent some time with him on Thursday night, I think it was, Thursday night. Dropped off some stuff to him, and we've sent him some money as a church. I know some of you had asked about that. The best thing that you can do right now is just send money. They're in a hotel. There's no room for stuff. They don't have, like, places to put things. They're still in transition. They're trying to find a house. They foster children, so there's some concern there. They need to have some stability, you know, some good housing setups for them. So just prayers, and if you would like to send some money to help them out, to buy little things, like he was telling me the other day, one of his boys' fingernails were scratching, getting along, you know, and he said, well, here, come here, let me cut your fingernails, and then he realized, I don't have a pair of fingernail cutters. Everything was lost in the house, pretty much, they think. There's some things that they'll be able to salvage, but they think that they're going to be probably... declaring the house a total loss. They use an 8-inch water hose to douse that fire. So you can imagine if it wasn't the fire damage and it's the water damage. So just pray for them. Totally unexpected and good family, good people. And he was almost in tears when I came and gave him some things for us. And I told him there's some money as well coming from the church. And he was just about in tears. And he said, it's been amazing. He's like, and I think for those of us who've never been in that situation before, we don't know until it happens how much this means, the church means to us. He said, the people of God have blessed me immeasurably. And he wants you to know that you have been the hands and the feet of God in doing that. And he's so grateful for you in your giving of your hearts, giving of your prayers and time as they try to get back and figure out what they're going to do next. The future is a little uncertain, as you can imagine, and they're not sure what's going to take place. So be praying for them. And he wanted me to pass along his thanks to you. Mark chapter 9, we're going to start in verse 30 and 32. kind of deal with a little bit of a section that's kind of an aside. It's not really anything to do with the sermon this morning, but I feel like I'm obligated to talk about it because that's just, we're going through the book of Mark, right? So Mark chapter 9, verse 30 through 32, Jesus and his disciples are kind of passing through places, they're going different places, and as they're going there, Jesus is starting to talk about his death, which is an odd thing to talk about as you're walking along the road. I don't know if you've ever shared with anybody your death before, like, hey, you know, in a little while I'm going to die, and when I die, this is what's going to happen. I mean, people get weirded out when you start talking about that stuff, right? If you've had grandparents ever say that to you, I remember my grandparents starting to talk about death, it made me very uncomfortable. And it makes the disciples very uncomfortable. In fact, it says they didn't understand the saying, and they were afraid to ask him. And so there's a little bit of confusion there on their part, and it seems that's the way things play out until the very end, until after his death. They don't really get it, what he was trying to tell them, but this is one of the things that Jesus was saying. He says, verse 31, the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him. And when he was killed, after 3 days, he will rise. And as they're continuing on the way, it says they come to Capernaum, and when they get to Capernaum, they have this conversation. It's kind of an interesting conversation, but before we get to talking about that, I wanted to ask you a question. I wanted you to think about somebody in your life that you would consider great. I mean, just think back to your years growing up, maybe a mentor of yours, a family member, a friend, somebody that you've watched in your growing up, or maybe even in your adult years as you've tried to emulate them, imitate them in your life. Who would you consider great and why? Why would you consider that person great as you think about them? What made them great? I'll come back to that in a second. But these disciples are having a discussion along the road, and it's kind of an embarrassing discussion because Jesus asks them when they get to the house, when they're staying, he asks them, what were you talking about along the side of the road? And they were caught because they were having a discussion about who is the greatest. As a parent, if you've had children, did you ever ask your child what they were doing when you knew full well what they were doing? And really all you were wanting them to do is to just fess up to it and come out with it. You just want an admission of guilt, right? That's really what you're looking for. You're playing dumb, but you're really wanting them to tell you because you already know. I remember back a few months ago, I was out and we had the kids out in the field a little bit, and I was trying to do something now at the house, and never leave your kids unattended in a field. I'll just say that. So I walk away for a minute, and I come back, and Isaiah's got a stick, and he's just whacking something. Whack, 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 whack. I'm like, what is he whacking? It's a cow pie. And I walk up, I'm like, buddy, what are you doing? And he's like, he's got this big grin on his face. He's just covered in poop. I mean, he's just loving every minute of it. He's just taking that stick and whacking. He's like, I'm hitting the dirt. You know, I'm like, yeah, that's not dirt. You keep telling yourself that. But I wanted him to tell me what it was. I already knew what he was doing. I knew exactly when I walked up and I saw his white shirt that was turned brown. I knew exactly what it was. But sometimes we do that with our kids. We just want them to tell us what they were doing. And sometimes it's more of a serious thing. It's not so funny, right? Sometimes it's a bad thing they did. You found out about it. They were out late. They did some stuff that they shouldn't be doing. And somebody talked to you about it. Word came back around and you already know. And so when they come into the house that next morning, have a seat, son. You want to tell me anything at all? And the playing dumb starts, right? I'm not just hanging out with friends. And then, of course, once you push a little bit further, there's the confession. And Jesus, I love it because Jesus already knows what they're saying along the road. He doesn't have to ask them. He's God, right? And I have to believe that at some level, they knew that he knew because they were embarrassed. And it says, in fact, that they didn't want to tell him they kept silent, for on the way they had argued with one another about who was the greatest. And he doesn't say anything. There's no admission. All he does is he sits down and he calls the 12 to him, which there's probably a group of people around, and he calls them down and he has them sit there. In verse 35, he wants to teach them a lesson. He's using this as a teachable moment, and he says, verse 35, if any one of you would be first, he must be last of all and servant of all. So without Jesus telling them, I already know what you were talking about them, they already know he knows. Jesus starts into this lesson on about greatness. And who is great? And what makes someone great? It seems like almost an odd thing to be talking about with a group of people. And yet this is what the disciples were doing. And whether or not we talk about it vocally with somebody or not, we are often measuring ourselves against other people, aren't we? I mean, we naturally do that as people. Well, I'm better at this than so-and-so. You know, you can most see it in kids with sports or something like that. Well, I'm better than so-and-so. I shot that ball better than so-and-so, blah, blah, blah. We're always measuring ourselves, always. And oftentimes that measuring ourselves comes against our abilities in something or some place in life. How well can we do? How well can we perform? What kind of a person are we? The merits that we have and bring to the table to make ourselves great or not. And Jesus says, no, this isn't how it works. If you want to be great, if you want to be first, you go last. True greatness is putting yourself first and others last. Back a few minutes ago when I asked you in your life, as you think about your life and who the people, significant people in your life have been, and I asked you to think about somebody that you would consider great in your life, chances are pretty good that there wasn't much about that person as far as ability or skill or talent or money, anything like that. There wasn't that that made them great. Chances are they were great because they put you first in their life. Maybe it was a grandparent who always made sure you had what you needed, took the time with you to talk with you, take you places, spend time with you, gave of themselves in your life. Maybe it was a teacher who would talk with you after school and would just say, hey, how's it going? They were interested in you. It wasn't that they had anything that they could offer you. It wasn't that they made a lot of money in life. It wasn't that they had titles or things attached to their name. It was because they did something significant and invested in you and put you first and themselves last. And I love what Jesus does next in verse 36 to further his point. He's still teaching the same thing. He's still talking about greatness. Verse 36, he takes a child. There must have been children around. And he brings a child over to him, says, come here. And he puts the child in front of the crowd. And I love how Luke says it. Luke's account actually states that Jesus knew the reasoning of their hearts and took a child and put him by his side. And he says, if anyone would be first, let him be the last of all, servant of all. Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. And whoever receives me receives not me, but him who sent me. You want to know what kind of a person someone really is? Look at how they treat children. Look at how they treat students at school. Look at how they treat kids running around in the church building. I love this story about George W. Bush. It's a famous story when the 9/11 Trade Center Tower attacks occurred. George Bush was in Florida. Some of you probably know this story. And he was doing a reading at an elementary school. He was trying to promote literacy, children's literacy, and so he was going on a little bit of a tour. And he was in this school reading with the children the story, The Pet Goat. That was the story that he was reading. I've never read the story, The Pet Goat, but that's the story that George W. Bush was reading with the students when he found out about the Trade Center attacks. And somebody comes in privately, the class is reading, he's sitting there listening to them read in the class, and somebody comes in and whispers, a plane hit the Trade Centers. And you can see it. There's pictures of this happening. You can see George Bush listening, concerned look on his face. And all of a sudden, pagers in the room start going off. Reporters are already in the room. They're covering the story of George Bush reading with this elementary school, and now all of a sudden they're getting information as well. There's been an attack. And slowly it dawned on everybody what was going on. But to his credit, and he was criticized for this at first, but I think history has been kind in this action, George Bush stayed in the room and read with the kids and finished the story. Because for that moment, he realized that the most important thing that I can do is stay here with these kids and make sure that I don't panic them, that I don't cause them any more grief or anguish or any sort of concern that's already going to happen as a result of what's going on in the world. I can't do anything right now except for be right here with these kids. Children are the great tests of our character, are they not? You thought you were a good person, and then you had kids. You know? What are you laughing about? You thought you were patient. You thought you were kind. You thought you had all the right words to say. And then some kid asks you about how babies are born, right? Or they come up and they want to talk to you and tell you the same story that they just told you 15 minutes ago, and it's a 5-minute story. They're easily ignored. You can easily ignore a child and they'll go away, right? You just don't listen to them long enough and they'll figure it out. They'll get the message and they'll go on to something else. And oftentimes in our brain, we think, well, they're just needing to listen to authority, we'll just be the parent, we'll ignore them and show them who's boss, and there's kind of a power deal going on there. They need everything from us, yet they give nothing back to us, really. You know, maybe a dandelion that they picked, right? Something sentimental that's actually not worth anything. But they really don't give you anything. I remember when, especially at the beginning of having kids, you know, it's all, there's a stage that of their development where they can't even acknowledge you. I mean, they're just, they don't recognize you yet. All they do is they cry and they scream for something as a baby. They're just needing fed. And it's exhausting in that stage because you don't get anything from them. And most of your childhood rearing years were probably spent in giving of yourself, your time, your energy, your money. And it felt like you're just bleeding like a stuck pig all the time. Their thought processes are odd and difficult to follow. You have to work to understand what they're saying to you, right? I mean, it makes sense in their little head. They're trying to tell you a story, and it makes sense to them. And you're trying to pick apart the pieces and put them together because they're also something that happened to them at school while you weren't there, or they happened yesterday when we were talking about something else, and they're putting all this together in their little brain, and they're so hard to follow. Can you tell them? I'm talking about personal experience here, right? But children are the great tests of our character. And yet, when someone who truly upholds and cherishes children does so, Jesus says, that person also receives me. You receive a little child, then you receive me. Jesus would say in other stories that unless you become like a child, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. The path forward involves a path backward for us in many ways. In this story, Jesus says, whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. Children have great lessons to teach us. On my desk, there are two Bible bucks. Back a few months ago, you might remember that we were doing a little promotional for our Bible students. We were giving them Bible bucks in class so that they could spend it, and they had a little store that they could buy from. And I meant to put them in my pocket. I forgot, actually, a little remission of guilt here. I wanted to bring them up to you because last Sunday somebody came up to me and said, I don't know what to do with this. There were two kids' Bible bucks in the plate, in the offering box. They wanted to give something. And there wasn't a plate passed around. It wasn't like somebody put a plate in front of them and said, hey, give something in this plate. They went back to the back, put it in the box because they knew that they were supposed to give to God something. Isn't the generosity of kids just awesome? They'll give you the shirt off their back half the time if they think you could use it, even if it wouldn't fit, right? When was the last time you threw in something important to you to give to somebody else? So the question is this, what makes someone great? We've talked about what Jesus says with children. We've talked about the disciples and their conversation, their desire to be great, then their embarrassment at their desire to be great and the lesson that Jesus is teaching them. And I think here's what it boils down to. If you desire to be great, if you desire to be important and significant, if you desire to leave a legacy in this world after you're gone, if you desire to people remember you well, here's what it boils down to. It all hinges on your ability to accept and receive the quote-unquote insignificant people in this world. The people that can give nothing back to you. The people that have nothing to offer you. How do you treat people who have no ability to give something back to you? Children, the mentally handicapped, someone from a different social class, someone who doesn't cross your path at any other place in life. It's easy to give to people who will also give to you. Right? We do this, we don't even realize it. We invite people over home who will also be able to invite us to their home. We take people to lunch who will also be able to take us to lunch at some point. We do things for people who will also be able to do things for us. But what Jesus wants to know is what happens with the children of the world? What happens with the people that can't pay you back? What happens when there's no ability to reciprocate because they don't have anything to offer? He says it like this in Luke chapter 14. You don't need to turn there. You can just listen. But Jesus talks about inviting people to a meal. He says this, verse 12, when you give a dinner or a banquet, Don't invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or your rich neighbors, lest they also invite you in return and you be repaid. But when you give a feast, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed because they cannot repay you. For you will be repaid at the resurrection of the just. We've made it a family tradition. I don't know where this happened, but somewhere along the line, we made it a tradition every January on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, which is a day that I have off. Here at the office, we have off. We go to Pittsburgh. Don't know where that happened. That's like the worst time of the year to go to Pittsburgh. It's freezing cold. It's on the water. Wind's blowing, right? We go to Pittsburgh. And the other, I think it was last year, we were in Pittsburgh, and we went to the Carnegie Museums in Pittsburgh. And I'd grown up hearing about the Carnegie Library, the Carnegie Museums, the Science, the Art Museum. Gorgeous place. If you've never been there, you need to go. Even if you don't like art. Okay, I don't like art, and it was still gorgeous. My wife likes art. But I was walking around this museum, and then started realizing, connecting things in my head this past week as I was recalling that trip to Pittsburgh and going to the Carnegie Museums and the Carnegie Library. What happened in Carnegie's life? Andrew Carnegie, maybe you know this, was a philanthropist. He was a rich man who made his money at an early age. He immigrated from Scotland when he was only 12 years old and began investing. He was one of those money types. Made good decisions in his life, invested into the railroad system at first, and then later spent time in the steel industry, which led him to be in Pittsburgh for most of his adulthood. He made lots of money. I mean, lots of money quickly. In fact, he made so much, by age 33, he drafted a memo to himself. He wrote this: "The amassing of wealth is one of the worst species of idolatry. No idol more debasing than the worship of money." And in order to prevent himself, he could see the way his life was working. He was making money and investments. In fact, by the end of his life, he was worth, in today's money, about $350 billion. Which, by the way, is more wealth than Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, or Elon Musk. A young immigrant boy from Scotland. He could see how things were going in his life. He knew that by the time he retired, if he was to go this way, he would have a ton of money. And so at age 35, he told himself that he would retire and pursue the gift of giving to other people. And he began his philanthropic work in his mid-40s. He would give, at his death, over $350 million dollars away. And he's most famous for the establishment of the Carnegie Library that started in Pittsburgh and then spread across the country. And today there are about 3,500 Carnegie Libraries in the country. And you ask, what's so significant about this? Any Carnegie Library that you go to is free. And he intentionally established these libraries as a way of giving back to the community in which they were placed. He didn't want anybody to have to pay for anything. He wanted to give it back to the community, to bless them. In fact, here's what he wrote to himself in a memo, talking about aspirations that people have in life and talking about all the things that he could do with his wealth and all the things that people do with wealth. He says this: "My aspirations take a higher flight. Mine be to have contributed to the enlightenment and the joys of the mind, to the things of the spirit, to all that tends to bring into the lives of the toilers of Pittsburgh sweetness and light. I hold this the noblest possible use of wealth." And he accomplished his goal. At his death, he expended all of his income in the avenues of giving it away to people who would never be able to repay him. Now, I don't know how much money you have, but I'm guessing that you don't have $350 million to give away. Maybe you have some. Maybe you have some money. Whatever amount you have, or whatever time you have, You may not have money, but what do you have that you can give to someone else? And specifically, what can you give that you can give to somebody else who cannot repay you ever? Because that is the truest measure of greatness. We are living in an increasingly narcissistic society, a society that places the emphasis on self, that seeks to increase views on YouTube and influence people and gain a following on Facebook or Instagram or different platforms and social media. That is the goal of our generation, of our current society, is to see how much attention can we get and how many people can we get to follow us. But Jesus says that's not how this works in the kingdom. You want to be great, be a servant. You want to be first, be last. How are you doing with that in your own life? We're going to sing a song of invitation as we do every Sunday. And just like every Sunday, you have the opportunity to respond either to this message itself or to the gospel. What better time of the year to respond to the gospel, by the way, than to respond it during a time of the season where we acknowledge the birth and the coming of Jesus to us. And if we could do that with you this morning, if we could celebrate and have the honor of baptizing you, we'd love to do that. To share more about the story of Jesus, or to just pray with you this morning. If any of you need anything, please come as we stand and sing.